No, it's definitely this button. We don't know what the other one does. Hello, survivors. This is Evan May, author of The King in Darkness and Bonhomme Setter.
And I'm sure it's perfectly fine. I'm Brandon Crilly, Ottawa-based author of science fiction and fantasy, and we're here to tell you about broadcasts from the wasteland. The end of the world is upon us, but not to worry. We are perfectly safe down here in our hermetically sealed bunker beneath the nation's capital.
We do have a lot of spare time down here in our subterranean refuge, though, so we've asked some of the most interesting writers we could get our hands on to come hang out. And now we're sharing those conversations with you.
We talk about things we read, things we wrote, games we played, and stuff we ate. We'll swap stories, share terrible advice, and always keep an eye out for spiders.
We'll discuss superheroes, creepy neighborhoods, indie publishing, video games, and hot toddies. If you've ever wondered what goes on in the lives and minds of your favorite writers, you'll want to check this out.
Keep the perimeter secure, survivors, and tune us in for season one of Broadcasts from the Wasteland. Wait, what does that switch do?
Podcastle, episode 586, for August 6th, 2019. The Masochist's Assistant by Austin Habershaw. Rated PG-13. Hello, and welcome to Podcastle. I'm Associate Editor Matt Dovey, your host for today, and I'm very excited to present for you The Masochist's Assistant by Austin Habershaw, originally published in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, July-August 2017. This week's story is rated PG-13 for blood, violence, and many deaths. Sort of. Austin Habershaw is a science fiction and fantasy author whose stories have been published in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Galaxy's Edge, Analog, and other places. The Far, Far Better Thing, the fourth and final book in his fantasy series, The Saga of the Redeemed, has just been released from Harper Voyager, so now is the perfect time to binge the whole series. Today's story is set in the same world, albeit with different characters, so if you do enjoy this one, you should absolutely go start with The Oldest Trick, the first in the series. He lives and works in Boston, Massachusetts, and spends his day teaching composition and writing to college students. Find him on his website at aahabershaw.com, or on Goodreads, Amazon, or on Twitter at @AustinHab. Your narrator today is, well, it's me. Because I was so excited about this story that I, A, pestered Austin to submit it, so I could, B, bump it up to the bosses, and then when they, C, agreed with my discerning and insightful bump notes, mostly consisting of, oh my god, I love this story so much, I, D, asked if I could host or narrate. To which Jen said I could do both, if I wanted. Which felt a little weird at first, because it's a long time since Podcastle has done that. But I wanted to have all the fun with the narrating, and I didn't want to let anyone else talk about the story after. Because I really love this story, and I want to do all the talking. So, here we are. You don't really need my bio again, I've been here enough. But if you really want to know more, here's what you should do instead. Go check out the Podcastle staff page under About Us on the website, because there's a lot of very cool, very clever people volunteering hours here, and they deserve to be lauded and celebrated and followed and supported. So there's your homework. Go see how cool all my fellow Castle Goblins are. But for now, it's story time. Brace yourselves. The Masochist's Assistant by Austin Habershaw. Narrated by Matt Dovey. Each morning, at precisely 7, Georges, famulus to Magus Hugarth Madswam, stabbed his master in the heart. It was a fairly complicated affair, as the linens needed to be spared staining, and Georges had to make the thrust quickly, lest his master wake up and become angry with him for failing in his duties. He had suggested abjuring the sheets against such stains, but his master claimed that doing so also meant his sweats would pool about his body during the night, rather than being absorbed by the sheets, and Georges' master refused to wake up stinking and slimy. So, no abjurations. As a result, Georges would leave his master's home at 6:30 and go to a nearby weaver, where he would purchase the previous day's linen scraps from her bleary-eyed son. Then, linen draped over one arm, he would return to the house, make his master's tea, bitter black, no sugar, place cup and saucer on a silver bed tray along with the teapot, still hot, and a long, slender chef's knife, as he was not permitted to wear a sword. He would then mount the narrow spiral stairs that led up to his master's bedchamber, carefully open the door without making a sound, and set the tray on the bedside table. Georges would take the knife in his right hand, drape the linen over his right shoulder, and, with the smooth gestures of a well-rehearsed assassin, pull back his master's quilts and sheets with a sweep of his left arm and stab the slumbering mage just to the left of the lower breastbone, piercing both the aorta and the heart itself with one plunge. Then his left hand would dart to the linen over his shoulder, and, just as he withdrew the blade, he would cover the wound with the new linen and hold it there as it quickly turned crimson all the way through. On occasion, Georges would find his master sleeping on his stomach, which made things more complicated, and was why he brought the longest chef's knife in the kitchen. One could stab the heart through the back, if needed, and he had done so often enough to count himself a master in that distinctly dubious art as well. This particular morning, though, Georges found his master on his back and stabbed him in the front almost without thinking about it. As his master's blood soaked through the linen, his mind was on the salon to be held in the silver room of Madame Grusson's chateau that evening. He had responded to the invitation in the positive without his master's knowledge, hoping that his master wouldn't want to go and send him in his stead when Georges pointed out that the event was tonight. This happened often enough to be reasonably certain, despite his master priding himself on his unpredictability. Georges pulled his ruffled sleeve up and away from the bloody linen with his free hand, and considered what he ought to wear to the salon, while gazing out the open window and over the rooftops of the village, and into the vastness of the deep summer blue sky. He indulged in a daydream, himself, the centre of attention at the salon in his periwinkled doublet, telling riddles that amused an array of high-born ladies. In time, though, he heard his master cough roughly, and Georges was pushed away by one meaty hand. Master Hugarth sat up in bed, blinking in the morning light. His voice was hoarse.
How long?
Georges felt the blood rush to his ears. Sorry, monsieur, I have forgotten to count. Master Hugarth groaned and rose from the bed, his hand scratching absently at the now scabbed over puncture in his chest. He was naked, hairy, and broadly muscular, like a sparsely furred bear.
And boots, boy, how am I to determine my progress at building an immunity if you won't hold up your end?
Georges bowed. I am deeply sorry, monsieur. I was distracted by the fine weather. It was a lie, perhaps, but an excusable one. Hugarth grunted and looked out the window. Georges poured the major's tea and handed it to him. Though the liquid was still piping hot, Hugarth drank it down at once without flinching.
Does look like a fine day. Think I'll go for a run.
Hugarth turned to descend the stairs, Georges at his heels. May I suggest some pants, monsieur? Georges' master turned and glared down at the simple canvas trousers clutched in his famulus's hands.
Ah, too beautiful a day for that.
Georges did his best not to frown or gasp. It was difficult, but he was getting better with time. Please, monsieur, think of the women. Hugarth's big teeth burst through his beard in an avalanche of a smile.
I am!
He tussled Georges' powdered wig with one hand before bounding down the stairs and out of sight. Georges heard the maid shriek before the front door banged open, and Hugarth, in a flash of hairy man flesh, was gone. Georges found himself no longer looking forward to the salon. It was later that morning that the repercussions of Master Hugarth's naked run through the village were felt. He and Georges were on the beach, hunting for brightly coloured, deadly venomous spinefish for Hugarth to ingest. This time, mercifully, Georges' master had elected to wear breeches, but nothing else. The hot summer sun made the master mage's broad, hairy back gleam with perspiration as he stood knee-deep in the ocean, hunched over and peering through turquoise water. Georges, safely on shore in a finely tailored doublet of white linen and burgundy breeches with gold piping, was trying very hard not to let sand infiltrate his shoes. He had removed his wig out of practicality. He was sweating like a feast day hog. He held a towel and a fisherman's hook, should his master need to be dragged out of the sea. That he felt like an idiot went without saying.
Aha!
Hugarth thrust his hand into the water and came up with a vermilion and ivory sea creature consisting of spines, one slimy foot, and precious little else. Spinefish of that colour could kill a child with their venom and put a grown man on his back for days. Hugarth crushed it in his hands like a piece of rotten fruit and stuffed the slimy, spiny concoction in his mouth, slurping it down without appearing to register any discomfort as the poison needles punched his cheeks, throat, and hand knew what else. Hugarth grinned at George, held his hands up in triumph, and then sank into a crouch as his windpipe closed and his eyes bulged. He vainly gasped for breath, like a fish on the dock. George watched dispassionately, wondering if it would be better if his master actually did manage to die. It was a miserable, traitorous thought, but it was there nevertheless. He looked out across the blue-green ocean, counting the sails on the horizon, and further wondered if it might have been better to remain in his uncle's house as an attaché. His uncle had been stern to the point of cruelty, but Hugarth was unbearable in his way. It was not that Hugarth was unkind, far from it, but being around Hugarth was like committing a gradual form of social suicide. Georges had thought becoming famulus to a master mage would have been a step up in social circles, something to separate him from the hordes of other second and third sons who swamped the courts of every noble family in Akral, something that might just have secured him an advantageous marriage. The dimensions of his naivete now appeared incalculable. Georges could never have imagined a master mage like Hugarth. Hugarth had stopped breathing, and his eyes were closed, but he hadn't fallen over into the water, so George imagined things were going according to plan. Probably. His own meagre magical training had barely touched on sorcery such as this. It was evidently an ancient discipline, one devoted to complete physical and spiritual mastery of the self, and achieved gradually through increasingly extreme experiences of physical trauma. Hugarth told him this once.
God of men, Han Longstrider, gifted to us, his children, a great truth at the dawning of the world. One cannot grow stronger without pain. So it was that the art of Hanahan, the eldest of all sorcerous disciplines, was born. The sorcerer tears the body and the spirit apart more and more severely, only to knit it back together ever stronger than before. In time, a man may even conquer most deaths.
Having seen his master die hundreds of times now in a wide variety of ways, Georges had no reason to doubt him. He did, however, have reason to wonder at the sanity of anyone who would pursue such a masochistic art. Fortunately, a famulus wasn't an apprentice. Hugarth wasn't expected to teach him. It was only necessary that he have rudimentary knowledge of the high arts sufficient to assist his master in any sorcerous undertaking. In the mind of young Georges, starry-eyed at the prospect of attending a master, such assistance had entailed the collection of rare materials and the preparation of dangerous and complex rituals, summonings, conjurations, grand invocations that shook the world. In practice, it appeared to involve standing on the beach with a fisherman's hook in order to retrieve his master's body, should his act of suicide actually succeed. Hoofbeats pounded over the dunes to George's back. Checking on Hugarth one more time, the master's face had gone from purple to a deep crimson, which was supposedly a good sign. He hastily slipped his wig back on and adjusted his posture to receive whomever was wealthy enough to risk galloping their horse over the uneven dunes. It was Edion, an attaché in the house of Lord Grusson, riding a stunning white Corisar mare from Chateau de Grusson's own stables, most likely. That Edion was dressed better than Georges went without saying. He even appeared to have abjurations in place to prevent perspiration. He looked as cool and comfortable as a man sipping lemonade in a shady gazebo. Georges tried very hard not to think how he, with his sweaty doublet and giant hook, looked at Edion. Edion dismounted and put an envelope out from under his vest. He gave Georges a perfunctory bow, just deep enough so that Georges could see the bridge of the taller man's nose from a more convenient angle. A good day, monsieur. I am pleased to have found you. The greeting was a formality, and Georges could read the cues as well as anyone. Edion was indicating that their behaviour was erratic and not gentlemanly, without verging on open insult. His shallow bow further indicated that he had little respect for Georges and no fear of reprisal, no doubt due to the fact that Edion was wearing a rapier and Georges had naught but a towel and a fishing implement. Georges bowed in return, deeper than Edion, indicating deference, and said, "My master regrettably was unaware that you would attend him this morning, monsieur. I offer his sincere apologies to yourself and to Lord Grusson." Edion's eyes flicked to Hugarth and blinked once. The gesture was a slap, an open insult. Wearing no rapier, Georges could do no more than pretend he hadn't seen it, but the gesture of disrespect for Hugarth, and by extension himself, still stung. Edion's voice was calm and measured. "I have a message from Madame Grusson for your master." Georges bowed again. "I will accept it on my master's behalf, as he is currently indisposed. He offers his thanks for your personal attention in this matter, and looks forward to receiving the noble lady's correspondence." Edion bowed and handed off the envelope. "Shall there be any message to send in return?" Georges knew not to look over his shoulder at Hugarth. Doing so would indicate that Hugarth hadn't been instructing his famulus in the particulars of house etiquette and his interests therein, which would have been embarrassing. Granted, Hugarth hadn't been doing that, but Georges would rather die than let Edion find out. Besides, he knew what the answer would have been had he asked. "There will be no response at this time, though my master offers his thanks for your generous accommodation in the instance that there had been." After one more bow and a formal farewell, Edion mounted the horse in one smooth motion and rode off. When he had gone, Georges turned back to his master. Hugarth was sitting in the water, the waves softly breaking on his broad back. He looked calm and at peace.
"Why did you put up with it?"
Georges didn't rise to the bait. "I'm afraid I don't understand, monsieur." He held out the letter. "A message for you." Hugarth rose and strode out of the water, snatching the letter from Georges' hand and ripping it open with his teeth. The sight of such behaviour used to make Georges dizzy, but now it merely made him uncomfortable. Hugarth held the letter up to the sun and read it quietly, then grunted.
"Looks like they're not inviting me to any more parties."
Despite himself, Georges' mouth popped open. "Is it true, monsieur?" Hugarth sighed.
"Unlike that fawning jackanapes you just spent 10 minutes bowing to, I do not lie to people I call friend."
The master crumpled the letter and moved to toss it in the sea, but Georges interposed himself. "Please, monsieur, may I see it?" Hugarth handed over the letter and began to stretch.
"Are you done with that? Go and get my foot weights, please. I'd like to practice drowning this afternoon. Such a lovely day for it."
Georges' eyes scanned the words over and over. They were flowery, impeccably polite, and immaculately written. But they said just what Hugarth had claimed. He was banned from polite society. No parties, no salons, nothing, from now until perpetuity. This meant Georges, too, had been just as ostracised. "Monsieur, you must find a way to undo this. This is most distressing." Hugarth regarded Georges with his deep, warm gaze, a gaze that seemed to swallow Georges whole and chew him up, tasting his every thought and gesture. To say it was rude was an understatement. Whenever his master looked at him this way, Georges felt naked. Still, he remained erect and kept his face calm. It would not do to lose any more control than he already had. At length, Hugarth shook his head.
"There's no call for you to feel inferior to these people, Georges."
"With respect, monsieur, you do not understand."
"Oh, I understand, all right. I refuse to accept. That's the difference. Emile Grusson and her senile husband are a pair of stuck-up old goats who seem to think the world revolves around them. They've got money, I'll grant them that, and they know their manners. But the supposition that you, Georges, are in any way inferior to them is preposterous. You've more courage in your left ankle than they have in their whole bodies. You're tough, you're a fighter, you're resourceful and thoughtful. Grovelling before a pair of middleweight nobility doesn't become you."
Hugarth brushed the sand off his hands. Georges did not scowl, but his stomach grew cold as he listened to his master defame his ancestral liege. He saw himself standing there on that beach in 20 years, fishing an older, fatter Hugarth out of the waves with the same damned hook. He saw himself laughed at in perpetuity as he tried to retain his dignity among the social elite. His life, once so full of glittering promise and honour, sank further and further from the light the more he thought about it. This, Georges decided, was the last straw. Monsieur, I am forced to tender my resignation as your famulus. Hugarth shrugged.
I don't accept it.
You must!
I don't have to do anything, boy. If you want to run off and brown-nose your way back into Grusson's sewing circle, you go right ahead. I think you're mad to try. Sooner you stop worrying about what everyone thinks, sooner you'll make a man of yourself.
Georges dropped the hook. His heart pounded in his chest as he found himself speaking out of turn. You have ruined my life, monsieur. You are no mage. You are a brute, a barbarian. Hugarth smiled, his eyebrows raised.
See? That's what I like about you. Guts!
He put a hand on Georges' shoulder. Georges could feel the weight of it, the power behind it, as though he were beneath the wheel of a carriage about to move.
I know I'm not what you were expecting. So many magi, oh, so many people in the world spend their whole lives looking for power all around them. That's not where it comes from. That's where it is, granted. That isn't the source.
He tapped Georges on the breastbone hard enough to make him flinch.
That's the source, boy. That's where it all comes from.
Georges ducked out of Hugarth's grip and adjusted his doublet. I take my leave, monsieur. Hugarth nodded.
Good luck, Georges. I mean that.
The village of Saint-Migron was where, 2 centuries earlier, Lord Grusson's ancestor had slain the Varisi pirate king, Thombri, in single combat, putting an end to his bloody raids along the Acralian coast and bringing peace and prosperity to the land. Accordingly, the Chateau de Grusson had been designed to look like a shipwreck. Georges knew this because he had studied history and heraldry under the stern tutelage of his uncle. It was worth noting that, had he not known this, he would have assumed the castle had been designed to look like a bouquet of flowers. It stood upon a promontory of limestone that thrust out into the village's small harbour like the hump of an albino whale. Its walls, also of limestone, gleamed in the summer sunlight and were gracefully curved to give the impression of the gunwales of some grand sailing ship, or, alternately, the gentle embrace of foliage at the base of the bouquet. The castle itself had 3 towers, each topped with a tapering spire and ringed by a broad balcony, forming the masts and spars of a ship, or the stems and blossoms of 3 flowers, depending again on one's level of education. To Georges, as he stood before the main gate, it was the most beautiful and most terrifying place he had ever been in his young life. The guards eyed Georges sceptically. Famulus? Georges bowed. It means servant of a mage. It's a Seldorian term. The master magus Hugarth Madsrom is my master. The lie burned on his tongue, but he told it anyway. If he wasn't a famulus, he was nothing at all. I know what it is, one of the guards replied. I would have expected you to arrive by coach, or at least have a horse. You walked from the village. Georges felt his ears colouring. My master believes strongly in physical exercise. The 2 guards exchanged looks, but neither said anything. They didn't have to. Such gestures were blatant insults to Georges' honour. He felt miserable. His parentage was good, his family was respectable. And yet here he was, being mocked by a pair of common house guards. For the 2nd time that day, he wished he had a sword, so that he might challenge them to a duel. But that, along with riding and coaches, was another thing Hugarth forbade. Things, actually. Hugarth had use for neither jewels nor swords. Georges was forced to answer the guards' questions meekly and politely, never allowing his gaze to waver or his inner embarrassment to colour anything other than his ears, which, at that moment, he wished he could cut off and cast into the harbour. Georges was admitted and shown into the presence of Madame Grusson, a social mercy in and of itself. The grand dame of the Grusin family sat upon a bleached wicker chair on the veranda that wound along the edge of one of the chateau's outer walls. In times of war, siege engines could be mounted upon it to defend the harbour from attack. In times of peace, it was littered with chaises and equipped with a small army of powder-wigged servants and attachés so that the dame of the house could enjoy the view in comfort. This latter use had enjoyed the run of the veranda for so many generations now, it appeared unlikely, should war arrive, that the war machines could be located, let alone deployed and used. Emile Grusin was a study in poise, sitting erect and graceful as though posing for a portrait. She fanned herself with a single lace-gloved hand. When she saw Georges, she did not acknowledge him, and so Georges awaited his audience among a small peripheral gathering of young ladies and attachés, which included Edillon. Georges bowed to him and mumbled a formal greeting at the proper volume for their current locale. Edillon rose off his seat by a few inches and nodded a formal reply. "Please, cousin, sit with me." A servant produced a chair for him and set it down close enough to Edillon to whisper, but not so close they might be confused for catamites. Georges sat. "You do me honour, cousin." Edillon did not look at him, but instead casually arranged his cravat. "I am surprised to see you. You visit the court so infrequently." The statement was really a question. Why are you here? But what to answer? Georges knew it would be unwise to reveal his purpose to anyone before he spoke of it with the Madame Grusin. But Edillon was the closest thing he might have to an ally in the room, and gossip was more valuable than currency at the court of an Acralian lord. He opted to be circumspect. "I have truly regretted my absence, cousin. I am diminished by the lack of such esteemed company." If Edillon was disappointed by the exchange, there was no outward sign. He turned away from Georges to compliment a young lady sitting nearby, and Georges did his best to appear at ease. In truth, his heart was racing. In a matter of minutes, Madame Grusin would acknowledge him, and then Georges would get his chance to escape the service of Master Hugoth once and for all. It would need to be delicately managed, though. Admitting one's mistakes did not, as a rule, ingratiate one to the powerful. Georges was forced to wait somewhat longer than he had anticipated. He requested a glass of chilled wine from a servant and sat very still, sipping it only so that he could demonstrate his appreciation for the Madame's hospitality. Around him, he noted the rumours swirling. They were obfuscated, of course. Little nuggets of juicy gossip wrapped up in gossamer packages of impeccable manners and 1,000 years of etiquette. But Georges' uncle had trained him well enough to see through the veils to the truth beneath. The rumours were about himself and Hugoth. Though no one said it directly, there was some doubt as to whether Hugoth was actually a master mage. He bore no staff, he worked no great rituals, he conjured no wonders. Additionally, there was speculation regarding what Hugoth had done to Georges during the term of his service. Some inferred they were lovers, others that Georges had been compelled by Hugoth to submit to brutish treatment, and a few, the most vicious of the rumours, supposed that the reason Georges had been forced into Hugoth's service was a direct result of impurity of the blood. It was implied that Georges' grandmother had been a commoner, or foreign. These things were predictable, of course. Georges reminded himself that they were inevitable, and that Madame Grusin knew enough not to put stock in rumour. But each of them still burned like hot needles laid against his skin. He reminded himself, for the 100th time, that he wore no sword and took care not to grope for one. It would be the height of foolishness to provoke a duel he couldn't fight. Georges suddenly realised the veranda had become quiet. He emerged from his inner musings to find Madame Grusin looking at him. Had she asked a question of him? God, why hadn't he been paying closer attention?
"Are you feeling perfectly well, child?"
the Madame asked, her voice cool and modulated to convey both concern and disdain in equal measures. Georges stood in order to bow deeply. "My apologies, Madame, but I fear your hospitality may have placed me at such great ease as to diffuse my attention." The Madame smiled briefly and extended her hand, knuckles first. Georges stepped to her side to kiss it gently. Her skin was dry and spotted, like an autumn leaf. She offered him a seat beside her.
Ordinarily, conversation would have resumed at this point, but in this instance it did not. All eyes were fixed on the famulus and the grand dame of the house. "How is Master Hugarth's health? It has been too long since I last saw him." With that, Georges knew the incident of the naked run through the village did not exist for the purposes of this conversation. Hugarth currently occupied a sort of non-existent status, as though he was somewhere beyond the sea and Georges was the only one receiving his correspondence. "My master is quite healthy, madame. He is nothing if not concerned with his health."
"I am gratified to hear this, child. Please, when you see him, send him our compliments."
That meant, "Whatever you do, don't bring him here." Georges bowed his head. This was his opening.
"It is my unfortunate duty to inform you, madame, that I have left Master Hugarth's service and therefore cannot guarantee that your wishes will be delivered in a timely fashion. Should you desire it, however, I could seek him out on your behalf."
A ripple of whispers orbited the veranda. Madame Grusson pretended not to notice.
"I would not inconvenience you, child. I would inquire, however, what you intend to do now that your service is at an end. Do you plan to journey to Saldor and enter the Arcane Ostrum?"
Georges' heart caught in his throat. The madame had come very close to banishing him with that last statement. Going to Saldor was essentially equivalent to running away from home in the middle of the night to avoid one's creditors. You might technically still be alive somewhere, but nobody wanted to socialise with you publicly. Those who took the staff in the Arcane Ostrum could own no property, hold no titles, and forget about marrying any Acralian lady of worth. If the madame actively thought that was where Georges belonged, he was through. He quickly devised a defence.
"I have regrettably learned very little of the high arts from my master, and would be a poor aspirant to earn my staff. And my strengths chiefly lie in history, heraldry, and etiquette, madame, skills of which Master Hugarth has little need."
There were a few chuckles from those assembled. Georges hoped they were laughing at his clever insult to Master Hugarth, and not at his assessment of his own abilities. He was very good with history and etiquette. His uncle, and his uncle's switch, had made certain of that. But this was another thing that his proximity to Master Hugarth had damaged. How could they understand the difficulty of dealing with a man like him? A man who did what he pleased and said whatever he thought? How did one maintain a proper demeanour in that environment? It was the greatest challenge a gentleman could endure. But of course there was no way to tell them that. Certainly not without being impolite for inferring their ignorance of something, which was simply not done to one's betters. Especially not without a sword. Madame Grusson's eyes flicked to Edion.
"Monsieur Edion tells us an interesting story, child. We have all marvelled at his wit, of course, but we are curious as to the truth of it. Does your master have you hold a fisherman's hook on the beach, so that you might save him from drowning?"
Georges felt the blood rush to his ears. He might have expected this. An amusing story could do wonders for an attaché's career, and Edion was as keen to climb the social ladder as he was. At that moment, Georges could see his future splayed out before him like an unconscious maiden on the edge of a precipice. The wrong touch, the wrong words, and she would fall to the rocks. He couldn't tell them the hook was his idea. Gentlemen did not carry hooks intended to haul fish into boats.
"A famulus must obey his master's commands, madame, and Master Hugarth's commands are often unusual."
Titters and giggles surged for a moment, and then subsided. Georges felt the sweat pooling at the small of his back. The veranda seemed suddenly crowded, claustrophobic. The moment was at hand. Georges waited to hear if his future would plunge to its death or slide into his arms. Though still sitting, Madame Grusson managed to look down her nose at him.
"Such loyalty would no doubt be appreciated by the magi of the Arcane Ostrum, famulus."
The observation was as hard and heavy as a blow to the guts. Georges felt his control slip and his face flush. Desperate, he gave one more try.
"I believe my services would be better appreciated here, madame."
Dead silence. Georges had gone too far. Madame Grusson regarded him with a detached gaze of a bored theatre-goer. You would no doubt be equipped to be my defender of the realm, child.
Her gaze shifted to the assembly, and her mouth curved into a half smile.
Alas, I am not a fish.
Georges flinched. His audience ended amid peals of laughter. There was nowhere to go but back to his master's house. Georges dragged his feet, staring at the late afternoon sky, trying to pretend he wasn't crying. Madame Grusson had ended him, as surely as if she had plunged a knife into his chest and tossed him off the battlements. She had suggested he leave Accra, and her suggestions were as firm as commands. Who would take him in now? He could be no one's attaché. His dreams of respected station and beautiful, sophisticated wife mocked him from the clouds. When he came to the door of his master's house, it was dusk. It stood open. The final humiliation. Hugarth had been expecting him to return. The burly master mage was sitting in the kitchen, two glasses of Schlurie brandy set out on the table before him. Georges did not acknowledge him. He threw himself into a rough wooden chair and cupped his face in his hands. He tried to stop his tears, but it simply led to his snuffling into his palms. Hugarth said nothing. The silence built around them both, a rickety tower ready to fall with a crash. It was Hugarth who knocked it down. Georges heard the glass of Schlurie slide across the table.
Drink it!
Georges kept his face hidden. Monsieur, it isn't appropriate for me to...
Drink it, damn it!
Georges peeked out at Hugarth between his fingers. The master's face was cemented into a frown, which was rare for him. It occurred to Georges that he'd never seen Hugarth look like this before. He appeared to bristle, as though he might tear off his robes and howl at the moon. Georges took the Schlurie and drank it. It was strong and just a little sweet, heating his throat as it went down. Thank you, Monsieur.
I've been unfair to you,
Hugarth said, downing his glass of the high-grade brandy in one gulp.
All that nonsense about not accepting your society. Forget I said that. A sense of cultural superiority is the easiest arrogance. You'd think if living among the Acralians would teach me anything, it would teach me that.
No apology is necessary, Monsieur. I should not have insulted you. Hugarth waved the apology away, which itself was rude, but Georges was too wrung out to take offence.
I assure you, Georges, you are incapable of insulting me. I have ruined your life, boy. I ruined it because I thought you needed a new life. What I saw was less, I don't know, less poisonous, I suppose. It's hard to remember sometimes what kinds of poison each of us thrives upon.
Georges felt the tears welling up again. Please, Monsieur, what's done is done. Let us not speak of it. Hugarth's face split into its old, familiar grin.
See, that's what I mean. That, right there. That's nobility, lad.
He shook his head and poured himself another glass of Schlurie.
There's maybe 5 men in 1,000 who could forgive so easily and mean it. You mean it, too. Maybe that's how you survive this place.
Georges blew his nose into his handkerchief. I'm finished, Monsieur. I am your famulus and nothing else. Madame Grusson, she made certain of it. Hugarth knocked back the Schlurie and grimaced.
What did the old bitch say?
Georges was too numb to register the slander of the Grande Dame, so he just told Hugarth what happened. As he told the story, he saw his master's face darken.
It was your insistence on holding the fisherman's hook. You didn't need it.
Georges sighed heavily. I feared for your safety, Monsieur. My duty to you felt more essential than my duty to present myself as a gentleman. I am sorry that I lied to them about it. Hugarth nodded slowly, his deep eyes somehow growing darker in the lamplight. A chill draught gusted through the room. The lamp flame flickered.
Doesn't matter whose idea it was. You stand ready to save my life and that woman crushes you for it? It's intolerable!
Monsieur, please, there is nothing you can do. Hugh Garth stood.
Oh, there's something all right.
Georges felt suddenly cold. The air around Hugh Garth's body seemed thicker, heavier. His every motion sent waves rippling through space, as though he were a whale in the summer air of the sea. Monsieur, I beg you, do nothing on my behalf. Hugh Garth seized Georges by the shoulders and enveloped him in a massive hug. He whispered in the young famulus's ear,
I'm going to make this right.
Before Georges could object, his master released him and strode from the kitchen and out of the house. Georges tarried another few seconds, at a loss for what to do. Then, with a sigh, he ran after his master. The gates of the Chateau du Grosson were thrown open for the Madame's salon. It was not a ball, so dress was correspondingly reserved. Ladies' gowns occupied perhaps half the acreage of a true ball gown, and men's wigs reached to their shoulders, not the small of the back. Women's jewellery matched the men's swords. Expensive, refined, but not showy, and nothing sported a ruby larger than a thumbnail. Overall, it was a modest affair for an Aquarian noble court. Even within these comparatively lax standards, however, Master Hugh Garth, in his tattered, rust-coloured robes, was not dressed to be allowed admittance. The two liveried valets out front, there to tend to the guests' coaches as needed, tried to find a polite way to tell the Master Mage this, as well as tactfully point out he wasn't invited. By the time they had arrived the way to do this, he had already stormed past them, with an out-of-breath Georges trailing behind. They made it to the main entrance of the keep itself before they were stopped. A pair of guards, silver mail glittering in the summer moonlight, crossed their halberds before Hugh Garth's path. Invitation, Monsieur? Hugh Garth regarded the two men evenly.
Step aside. I have business with the lady of the house.
Georges bowed politely to the guards, trying to hide the fact that he had been forced to run nearly the whole way from home to keep up with his master. Please excuse him, Monsieur. He is not himself. The guards didn't budge. You may not enter, Monsieur, as you are not invited. Hugh Garth placed a single finger against the blade of one of the men's halberds. The metal immediately began to smoke and glow. Inside a half second, the entire weapon was blazing hot, either melting or burning from the inside out. The guard dropped it with a howl and clutched his hands to his chest. Hugh Garth's tone was steady.
Who are you to hinder a master of the Arcanostrum? Step aside or be cast aside. Your choice!
The two guards stepped back immediately, their eyes bulging. Georges apologised as best he could, but Hugh Garth was already striding deeper into the confines of the castle. He hurried after the burly mage.
Monsieur! Monsieur Hugh Garth, please! This is not necessary! Please!
Georges could not see the expression on his master's face, but it must have been terrible. Servants and guards scattered before him like mice before a cat. Doors were closed and locked against him. Even Lord Grusson's head chamberlain dove behind a tapestry rather than confront him. When they arrived at the great doors to the chateau's silver room, they were alone. Beyond those great doors, the Madame's salon could be heard, a large crowd engaged in the light rumble of polite conversation.
Please, Monsieur!
Georges was tugging on Hugh Garth's sleeve.
No!
Hugh Garth ignored him. He raised his thick hands above his head and clapped them together, producing a sound so thunderous it forced Georges to his knees. The doors were torn from their hinges as though struck by a battering ram. They crashed against the silver room's polished black and white checkerboard floor and slid 10 feet, toppling a few well-dressed men and causing a half dozen corseted women to swoon. The party fell silent, but this was a different silence from the one that had greeted Georges when he had pled for a place in the Madame's household. These people were terrified. Hugh Garth stepped into the room like a conqueror surveying his captives.
Where is Emile Grusson?
Edion stepped forward, his hand resting on the pommel of his rapier, and placed himself in Hugh Garth's path.
You, Monsieur, will leave at once, or I pledge to face you on the field of honour!
The attaché hadn't gotten a third of the way through his formal challenge before Hugh Garth seized him by the cravat and the codpiece, hoisted him over his head, and threw him across the room like a bale of hay. Edion struck the opposite wall a full 8 feet off the ground and fell to the floor with a heavy thud. Hugarth dusted off his hands.
Anyone else want to try that?
Dead silence. Georges was rooted to his place, 2 paces behind his master. He couldn't form words. He couldn't blink. He could scarcely breathe. This couldn't be happening. How could this happen? What could he do?
I ask one more time, and then I become unreasonable.
Hugarth planted himself in the centre of the room.
Where is Madame Grusson?
The assembled nobility parted, their eyes downcast as though they had just noticed they had dropped something and all happened to be wandering in a direction away from their hostess to look for it. Madame Grusson was there, this time sitting in a glittering throne made of translucent mage glass and upholstered in satin. Her hands were folded around a small dog that yapped and growled at the mage.
"This is a grave offence, Master Hugarth. You have insulted..."
Hugarth cut her off.
"No, Emile, I am insulted. You seem to have it in your head that I should somehow be afraid of you. And I'm here to demonstrate to you, in terms so clear even you can understand, just how incorrect you are."
"Guards! Guards! To arms!"
Madame Grusson's voice cracked as she shrieked. In the distance, a bell rang. Hugarth grunted out a harsh laugh, and, with a wave of his hands, the doors he had just smashed from their hinges flew back to the doorway and sealed themselves as tightly as if they had been barred.
"No guards for you, Emile. Just you, me, and this assortment of cowards and sycophants you call nobility."
"Edion!"
the madame called to her attaché, who was just pulling himself to his feet. No one had helped him. His face was pale, his hands shaking.
"Edion, protect my honour!"
Edion didn't answer. He looked at the ground, pretending not to hear, and drifted toward the back of the crowd. Hugarth laughed and shook his head.
"He's all hot air, that boy. Just like the rest of you. All talk, no substance."
"What do you want?"
Madame Grusson was hugging her little dog to her chest. It yapped, but was trembling almost as much as everyone else.
"Apologize!"
"What?"
The madame blinked as though slapped.
"What have I done to you?"
Hugarth shook his head.
"Not to me, to him!"
The master levelled one thumb-thick finger at Georges. Georges and Madame Grusson had the same reaction at the same time.
"No!"
Hugarth took a single step towards the seated old woman, and the entire room shook with its weight. The chandelier swayed, sending flickering shadows along the pale faces of the assembly.
"Behind me stands a boy of courage! Of kindness, one so damned enamoured with your idiotic Acralian etiquette that he'd do anything for you, and you treat him worse than that ugly dog you're currently throttling. Apologise to my famulous Emile. Also help me, I will take you over my knee and stripe your ass."
"Monsieur, this is madness," Georges cried, his shock subsiding. "There is no need for this."
Hugarth clenched his fists, and Madame Grusson's chair shattered into a million glittering slivers, dumping her on the ground. She cried out in pain, but no one ran to help her.
"I am of House Grusson," she cried. "I will never..."
"You will!"
Hugarth bellowed, and every flame in the room flared to 5 times its size. Candles became pyres, and the great hearth belched a crimson fireball that set a few gowns ablaze. People screamed and huddled to the ground. Master Hugarth loomed over the prone body of Emile Grusson, his face a rictus mask of rage. The old woman wept and tried to crawl away. Georges could take no more. He seized the nearest attaché and drew the man's rapier.
"Monsieur," he yelled, extending the sword towards Hugarth's back, "I cannot allow this. One more step and I will kill you."
Hugarth turned around slowly. When their eyes met, there was something strange about the Major's expression. Georges, though, was too terrified to make sense of it.
"You ungrateful snake!"
Hugarth's voice sounded not his own. This angry, vengeful Hugarth appeared to have consumed the kindly, brusque Hugarth Georges had come to know. It was like facing a nightmare.
After all I've done for you!
Georges advanced a step, his blade pointed directly at Hugarth's chest. Your friendship is appreciated, monsieur, but I cannot allow you to terrorize an Acralian lady.
You are my famulus!
It took all of Georges' will to keep the blade from trembling and his voice firm. I beg your forgiveness, monsieur, but I am an Acralian first.
So be it,
Hugarth said. He took a step, but that single step carried him across the room in the space of a breath. He loomed over Georges like a tidal wave, and the famulus felt himself struck in the chest so hard he thought his heart would stop. Georges tumbled through the air. He heard the breaking of glass and felt the rush of the cool night air around him as he fell. He struck the catwalk at the top of the curtain wall, bounced once, and slammed against the crenellations. Pain exploded all over his body, and the world swirled. Staggering to his feet, he saw that Hugarth had knocked him out the great window of the silver room and sent him sailing 60 feet across the courtyard. Had his trajectory been any higher, Georges would have gone over the battlement and fallen into the sea. God, he gasped. Hugarth appeared in the window himself and, with a single leap, crossed the space as well. He landed 5 paces from where Georges lay, the force of his arrival causing the wall itself to tremble. Georges felt his bowels loosen. He was going to die.
Now I end you, whelp!
Hugarth bellowed in an unnatural volume, as though Georges were 5 miles distant. Georges' eyes searched for the sword. There it was, halfway between him and his master, lying against the stones. Both he and Hugarth saw it at the same time, and both rushed for it. Adrenaline laced through Georges' body with a heat of strong chivalry as he reached for the blade. He felt the hilt in his hand and brought up the point. By some miracle, he had arrived first. Hugarth had too much momentum. He could not stop. The blade's tip pierced the major's chest in just the right place. Georges, after all, knew exactly where to find his master's heart. Blood bubbled from the wound. Eyes wide, Georges looked up into his master's face one last time. Hugarth, the old Hugarth, the one he had always known, smiled, gave him a wink, and toppled over the battlements and into the sea far below. It was 3 months before Georges saw his former master again. He was riding through the countryside along a winding, wooded lane, with the scent of autumn in his nostrils and a chill in the air. The steed, a fine black Thalusian stallion, bucked slightly as they came around a bend to find a burly, hairy man hanging by the neck from a tree branch. Georges smiled and dismounted. He cut Hugarth down with a careful stroke of his rapier and waited. A minute or so later, the Master Mage opened his eyes.
What? Oh.
He sat up and smiled.
Guess my new famulus ran off.
You have odd habits, monsieur. Do not hold it against him. Hugarth stood up and stretched his now unbroken neck.
Of course not.
He gave Georges a look over, noting the royal blue ribbon he wore at the shoulder.
Defender of the realm, eh? So it worked, then?
Madame Glousson had little choice. Her honour could not sustain slighting the honour of her saviour. She was, Georges searched for the words, most apologetic for her earlier misjudgments.
I'll bet.
Hugarth snorted, shaking his head.
Sorry for that whack. Glad I hit it just right. I was worried I'd given you a bit too much spin and you'd sail off into the harbour.
Georges found himself suddenly at the limits of Acralian etiquette. There was, to his knowledge, no proper way to handle such an apology as this. After a moment, he managed to say, "That's all right, monsieur. And thank you. Thank you for understanding." Hugarth nodded slowly, frowning.
"I would have taken you with me. Might have knocked all those stupid Acralian habits out of you. But..."
He shrugged.
"It's your life, Georges. Never forget that."
Georges had no reply. He could think of none. Such bluntness. Such clarity. It was a thing not cherished among his people. A and yet it was a treasure in its own right. He could see that now. Hugh Garth looked around, as though searching for a topic of conversation. He found none.
"Suppose it is goodbye, then!"
He held out his hand. Georges buried his smile and drew himself to rigid attention. He bowed deeply. "Monsieur, it comes to my attention that you may be in temporary need of sorcerer's assistance." He gestured to his rapier. "If you would permit me, one last time, perhaps." Hugard's face split into a monstrous grin. With both hands, he spread the laces of his shirt, baring his chest to Georges.
"Don't forget to count!"
He winked. For the first time in what felt like an age, Georges began to laugh.
Welcome back. It is a very satisfying story, isn't it? Absolutely one of my favourite ever fantasy shorts. For me, it's the two main characters and their relationship that make this, Georges' resignation at honour and Hugarth's joie de vivre and their contrasting styles of presentation. It's an absolute delight to see their interplay, but also to see their bond and their decency, and to recognise, despite seeming so different on the surface, that underneath they're a lot closer to each other than to anyone around them. Austin had this to say. The story was originally inspired by the word Mithridatism, and the original title was The Mithridatist. I eventually changed it because C.C. Finlay thought the word was too divorced from the content of the story and wanted to see it actually appear in the text. I resisted because I felt the word was too tied to real world history. Mithridates VI was a Greek king who regularly ingested small quantities of poison to try and develop an immunity for it to fit into a secondary world setting. For me, as a writer, speaking as Matt again, this story pulls one of my favourite tricks. It illuminates a society by showing you it through an outsider's eyes. China Mieville does this a lot. Lynn in Perdido Street Station was the first time I really recognised this trick working. It's a brilliant way of layering all your world building with tension, of using every occasion for info dumping as an opportunity for conflict too. There's another story we ran a few weeks ago that does the same, coincidentally from the same issue of FNSF as this one, called I Am Not I by G.V. Anderson. If you enjoyed this one but missed that one, you should definitely go back and check it out. And another reminder too, while we're at it, to check out Austin's novels in the Saga of the Redeemed, starting with The Oldest Trick. And that was our show for this week. On behalf of everyone at Podcastle, our audio engineer Peter Berevesh, our forum moderator Ossicat, your glorious co-editors Jen Albert and Sheree Clark, and assistant editor Setsu Uzume, along with all our fantastic first readers, Crystal Claxton, Aidan Doyle, Ebony Dunbar, Amalia Harrington, Kai Hudson, Ekpeki Ognachoywe, Catherine McMahon, Devon Martin, Ace Ratcliffe, Julian Jarbeau, Craig Jackson, Julia Pat, Hamilton Perez, Eleanor Wood, and of course myself, Matt Dovey. Thank you for letting us share another story with you. Be sure to share it in turn with your friends, family, plants in your garden, any dogs you see, clouds that look like people, anyone. Hit us up on Facebook and Twitter, and don't forget our new Instagram account at Escape Artist Podcast. If you would like to show the show some extra love, head to patreon.com/EAPodcast for special events, bonus episodes and podcast appearances in the wild. And lately, there's swag and also an exclusive EA Discord channel just for patrons. The legal stuff. Podcastle is part of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License, which means feel free to share it, and please do. Don't sell it, and don't change it. We'll be back next week, as always, with another tale. Until then, this is Matt Dovey, reminding you that if you practice at anything long enough, you can pull off the impossible.